welcome to this week's EHS podcast for the week ending January 9th. I'm Linda Hechtel.
And I'm Allison Granke.
And we are bringing you the latest news in environmental health and safety. So our first story, I understand, Allison, is about an update in the oil industry.
Yeah, so oil companies and environmental advocacy groups are squaring off in California this month after new restrictions have been imposed on the oil industry in the name of protecting water safety. California is the U.S.'s fourth largest oil-producing state, and therefore the measures it puts into place to manage wastewater and its disposal, and also the regulations enacted to protect water quality, can have a significant impact. So, in fact, in 2013, California produced 8 billion gallons of oil, but 130 billion gallons of wastewater. So that's 15 barrels of wastewater for every barrel of oil. In the past, the EPA has criticized California for its implementation of the EPA's Underground Injection Control Program, also known as a UIC program. This program regulates how wastewater from hydraulic fracturing operations is disposed of into underground injection wells that are deep below the surface of the earth. So these injection wells can be close to underground sources of water that are used for drinking and agriculture, making their regulation very important. The EPA has suggested that in California, the Division of Oil and Gas Resources has implemented a one-size-fits-all risk assessment for the protection of waterways that doesn't adequately address all the risks. And because California is also a region where small earthquakes are not uncommon, there's an increased risk of these wells being compromised, and there's a possibility of wastewater being transported through the faults and contaminating those underground sources of water for drinking and agriculture. So these new restrictions in California affect something called aquifer exemption requests. Aquifer is a type of underground rock layer, so such as sandstone or fractured limestone, that's permeable and therefore can contain or transmit groundwater. Aquifers are a concern in the process of hydraulic fracturing, which is commonly known as fracking, because fracking chemicals that are injected into the ground may be able to travel through aquifer and contaminate drinking water. So the aquifer exemption program allows oil companies to request to be allowed to inject fracking wastewater underground for disposal in an area that also contains aquifer nearby, thus potentially contaminating drinking water. This week, environmental organization Clean Water Action released an analysis of the aquifer exemption program, which showed that implementation and oversight of this program is both inconsistent and potentially inadequate, meaning that drinking water is being compromised and the EPA doesn't know how many sources of drinking water may have been written off. So near the end of 2014, a couple reports surfaced showing that California regulators weren't enforcing proper wastewater disposal. And according to state documents obtained by the Center for Biological Diversity, almost 3 billion gallons of oil industry wastewater have been illegally dumped into central California aquifers that supply drinking water and farming irrigation. At least 9 wastewater disposal wells have been involved in injecting waste into aquifers. So the new restrictions are meant to protect aquifer and drinking water, but oil industries are fighting the document that lays these restrictions out. They're concerned that there will be no place to put the wastewater and that the restrictions effectively halt their operations. The ultimate concern here is that drilling activities could be endangering the U.S.'s clean water supply. So hopefully this will be an occasion for some innovative thinking and a solution can be reached that will satisfy both the environmental groups and the oil industry while protecting the state's clean water supply. And Linda, I think you were going to talk to us about the top clean energy trends of the year.
Yes, I am. So every year, Clean Edge produces the report called the Clean Energy Trends Report. Essentially, this report sizes global markets for solar, wind, biofuels, and tracks market activity, including activity on the stock market and global investment in this area. They look at top trends. One of the top trends that they highlighted was an expanded move towards a 100% renewable position. So basically what's supporting this idea that this is a trend is the notion that some pretty significant corporate and governments are moving in this general direction. Here are a few examples that are cited in the report. Apple has moved from primarily fossil fuels to 100% renewable activity. Amazon's data center operations recently joined other tech leaders like Facebook and Google in announcing their plans to get to 100% renewable. Denmark, this of course is from a country perspective, reaffirmed its commitment to get to 100% renewables for its entire energy supply, including transportation, by 2050. And it's close to reaching its goal of 50% renewables on its electricity grid by 2020. Another trend is the evolution of solar energy and its competitiveness. Now, we've covered this topic of solar energy a few times on EHS this week. What's supporting this trend is the fact that the energy storage sector is becoming more competitive. So companies are really vying for the opportunity to be able to provide customers with more cost-effective and reliable energy sources. California, from a state perspective, is ripe for developing this area because it wants to be the first in the nation to achieve an energy storage mandate. New York and Texas are also looking to integrate more renewable energy into their system to ease the strain and create more of a resilient grid during the times of peak electricity demand. Globally, Japan is also looking to expand its energy storage efforts as part of its latest economic stimulus package. Although the cost of solar power is still an issue, again, we've talked about this in the past, pricing is starting to reduce, and as prices continue to decline, energy storage will become a larger and more integral part of the energy landscape. Stay tuned to future EHS podcasts to find out more of other upcoming trends as it relates to clean energy. So, Allison, I understand that your next story is about coal mining?
Yeah, the U.S. Department of Labor's Mine Safety and Health Administration, also known as MSHA, has released preliminary data from 2014, and there's some good news. The number of fatal work-related mining accidents has decreased from the previous year, and coal mining deaths in particular are at an all-time historic low. Coal mining deaths dropped from 20 in 2013 to 16 in 2014, which is the lowest number of coal mining deaths in a year ever recorded in the United States. The previous record low was 18 deaths in 2009. Now, you might be thinking that this is because there are just less miners mining coal, and while that's true, the number of deaths in 2014 is about half what the mining industry saw in the early 2000s, and the number of working coal miners during these two time periods were at comparable levels. In total, MSHA's data indicates that 40 miners died in work-related accidents in 2014, which is two fewer than in 2013. And while it's always encouraging to see these numbers moving in the right direction, it's important to remember that that's still 40 workers who went to work at the start of their day and did not return home at the end of it.
So, Allison, what can mining companies learn from these tragic accidents?
Well, the most common causes of mining accidents this past year involved powered haulage and machinery. So these accidents involved equipment used to transport people, materials, or supplies, and the machinery accidents are associated either with the action or motion of the machinery or a failure of component parts. So these types of accidents highlight the importance of proper training for individuals who will be operating this equipment or even just be working in the vicinity of the equipment. And it also emphasizes the necessity for thorough and frequent equipment inspections conducted by a qualified employee. For those who are interested, MSHA has provided an analysis of 2014's mining fatalities along with recommended preventative practices for mining operations, which you can find on its website. And we've also provided a link to this in the resources section of this podcast.
Thank you, Allison. And that's it for this week. Thanks, everyone.
Have a safe week.